Welcome to Simply Scottish, a podcast of all things Scottish, with music, features, interviews, and more, on the web at www.simplyscottish.com.
Welcome to Simply Scottish. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Andrew McDermott. On this episode, the first of a series on the Scots in Canada. Be part of our listener community online. Visit simplyscottish.com to browse other episodes of the show and get in touch with us. Like us on Facebook for episode updates, news, trivia, and our monthly music giveaway. Or you can follow us on Twitter with the handle @simplyscottish. Let's begin, as we always do, with music. Chris Norman was born in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and studied the traditional music of Canada, including Scottish, Irish, and French-Canadian styles. From the album The Caledonian Flute, this is Branle de Cosse. Thank you. You're listening to Simply Scottish. For centuries, Scots have emigrated around the world, creating a giant diaspora that has made a significant impact on the history and development of nations in Europe, the Americas, Asia, Africa, and Australasia. Thousands of Scots, many of whom left due to political or social upheaval, braved the challenges and unknowns of the immigrant life and found success on foreign shores. Perhaps no country's history has been shaped more directly by the Scots than Canada. This episode is the first of a series exploring Scottish influence in the establishment, development, and collective character of Canada. The Aboriginal peoples in Canada and the Native Americans in the United States have been trading products of the land among themselves for much of their history. This trade expanded to Europe when explorers reached the New World, beginning with French explorer Jacques Cartier and his voyages to the St. Lawrence River in the 16th century. The fur trade grew as a response to the demand for animal furs in Europe. Although beavers would be the main commodity, skins from otter, fisher, mink, weasel, fox, lynx, wolf, hare, and wolverine were also traded. Things continued to develop with the establishment of Quebec in 1608 by Samuel de Champlain. Soon Britain began to compete with France to control fur trade interests. Henry Hudson discovered Hudson Bay in 1610, and in 1670 a royal charter established the Hudson Bay Company as the centre for the British fur trade. The company took control of all lands that drained into the vast bay, making up a third of the area of modern-day Canada. The HBC lost no time in establishing posts around Hudson's Bay, eventually pushing inland. The company began to recruit Orcadians from the Orkney harbour town of Stromness, young, tough, dependable workers. Soon, four of every five employed by HBC were hardy Orcadian Scots, who, according to one historian, pooled the wilderness round them like a cloak and wore its beauty like a crest. Thousands of Scots immigrated to Canada during the 18th and early 19th centuries. The Jacobite Uprising of 1745, the Battle of Culloden the following year, and the ruthless government actions that followed were crucial turning points for the Highlanders in Scotland. Unable to defend their way of life, many clan members left their country to find freedom and livelihood elsewhere. Another catalyst for emigration was the Highland Clearances, an era that saw many Highland families forcefully evicted to make way for sheep farming. One man who attempted to preserve the Highland way of life was Thomas Douglas, the 5th Earl of Selkirk. Born in 1771, he inherited his family title and set out to establish Highland settlements in Canada. In 1803, he settled 800 Highlanders on land he purchased in Prince Edward Island and established a settlement at Baldoon in Upper Canada. A few years later, after purchasing a controlling interest in the Hudson Bay Company and securing a large land grant from them in what is now Manitoba, he started the Red River Colony. Selkirk's efforts, though noble, were largely thwarted by conflict with fur traders, locals, and government officials. It seemed the fur traders were not quite ready to live peaceably with permanent settlers. Nevertheless, Selkirk's settlements helped to support British territorial interests. Eventually, the dominance of the Hudson Bay Company would be challenged by a Scotsman named Simon MacTavish, a Highlander who emigrated to New York at 13 and eventually moved to Montreal. His work would also pave the way for the remarkable explorations of another Scot, Alexander Mackenzie. More on these and other Scots in early Canada after music from Canadian group Leahy. This is the Cape Breton Medley.
Thank you.
In 1783, a Scottish fur trader in Montreal named Simon MacTavish brought together several small independent trading companies under one roof to create the Northwest Company. MacTavish led the new company with efficiency and vision, and during his tenure, a large number of Scots found employment. Rather than wait for natives to bring furs to them, the Northwest Company established a network of posts and distribution centres along key routes, actively bartering with natives along the way and transporting pelts back to Montreal. By 1800, MacTavish controlled 70% of the fur trade, gaining wealth and causing the rival Hudson Bay Company much concern. The Northwest Company secured the services of voyageurs, young independent French Canadians who would trek thousands of miles by canoe to transport goods and traders. In 1803, American author Washington Irving spent several days with the Scottish merchants of the Northwest Company on a trip to Montreal. Irving admired the drive and success of the company's men, calling the Scots the lords of the lakes and forests, and the voyageurs Sinbads of the wilderness. Irving would later write a book of the fur trade, called Astoria, and included these words at the beginning. While the fiery and magnificent Spaniard, inflamed with the mania for gold, has extended his discoveries and conquests over those brilliant countries scorched by the ardent sun of the tropics, the adroit and buoyant Frenchman and the cool and calculating Briton have pursued the less splendid but no less lucrative traffic in furs amidst the Hyperborean regions of the Canadas, until they have advanced even within the Arctic Circle. It was the fur trade, in fact, which gave early sustenance and vitality to the great Canadian provinces. Alexander Mackenzie was a Scot from the Isle of Lewis and a partner in the Northwest Company. In 1789, he led the first of two expeditions attempting to find an overland route from Montreal to the Pacific Ocean. Although his first attempt failed, he staked a British claim to the West Arctic seaboard, and the journey served as good preparation for a second attempt. After a time in London to study astronomy and navigation, he set out on a second expedition in 1792. With a team of 9 companions, Mackenzie blazed a trail over land and water from Fort Chipewyan in present-day Alberta, across the rocky and coastal mountain ranges, to the waters of the Great Pacific. They cover 1,200 miles of Canada's rugged backbone, taking 74 days to get there and making it back in a mere 33 days in spite of dwindling food supply and encounters with some unfriendly natives. Mackenzie was the first white man to travel overland from Canada's interior to its western shores, and his success helped solidify British claims to the Western Territory. His was the first east-to-west crossing of North America north of Mexico, predating the Lewis and Clark expedition by 10 years. He published an account of his voyages in London in 1801, and received a knighthood soon after. The largest and longest river system in Canada, the Mackenzie River, is named in his honour. By the turn of the century, many were calling for the Northwest Company and the Hudson Bay Company to merge, to extend trade and defend British interests against an ever-increasing American expansion. The two trading companies did exactly that in 1821. Another Scot, George Simpson, would take the helm after the merger, and in exacting and sometimes ruthless fashion, Simpson streamlined the company's business and allowed the fur trade to continue to flourish for decades. Under his direction, the enlarged Hudson Bay Company helped prepare the Canadian territories for settlement by establishing and expanding trade routes that would later become towns and cities. Although he did much for the company, he set a bad example for workers in his relationships with native women. A great many fur traders took native wives during their career, producing mixed offspring known as the Métis. For some, these unions were temporary, and for others, they lasted long after their employment was over. Simpson took several native country wives and mistresses, producing many children. He was often inconvenienced by these women, sometimes referring to them as his bits of brown or unnecessary appendage. This aspect of the man mars his legacy as a successful company governor at a crucial stage in the fur trade. Thank you. In a few minutes, I'll look at more Scots who played key roles in turning Canada into a nation. Here's a song from Mary Jane Lamont, from her 2005 solo album promoting Nova Scotia's Gaelic tradition. This is Oran Lua. This is Simply Scottish. On this episode, we're exploring the influence of the Scots in the history and development of Canada. By 1860, silk had replaced the demand for furs in Europe, and the fur trade dwindled. But the trade paved the way for the nation building that would follow. The fur trade was Canada's first large-scale commerce, and all other businesses evolved from it. It opened up the country, north and west, and it guarded British interests, effectively safeguarding Canadian sovereignty and culture from an imposing American neighbor, not unlike the way Scots had to work hard to safeguard their interests from their southern neighbor back home. In short, two centuries of trade and exploration built the foundation upon which Canada was built. Two Scots we can thank today for helping to safeguard the unique multinational character of Canada were James Murray and Lord Elgin. Murray, a British Army officer from East Lothian, served under General James Wolfe in the Battle of the Plains of Abraham. He was military governor and later became the first civil governor of the province of Quebec in 1764. As a leader, Murray was sympathetic to the French Canadians, helping to preserve their cultural and linguistic distinctiveness. He ignored the oppressive Royal Proclamation of 1763, and although he was recalled by the British and grilled in Parliament, he continued to serve until 1794, treating the French Canadians not as a conquered people, but as equal citizens. James Bruce, Lord Elgin, was a Scottish noble whose actions during his leadership in Canada are considered by many historians to be key moments in the birth of Canadian democracy. Canada had been divided into two distinct portions, Upper and Lower, since 1791. It was a time of political turmoil, driven by personal agendas, warring factions, and an absentee parliament. As Governor-General, Lord Elgin encouraged political opponents, who included Scots on both sides, to come together and cooperate. Under his leadership, a ban on the French language in government was lifted. An example of his unmoving commitment came in a speech he gave as governor. He delivered it first in English. Then, after a pause and a smile, he proceeded to deliver it in fluent French as well. Thanks to the efforts of people like Lord Elgin, Canada became a confederation in 1867. Another Scot instrumental in making this happen was John Alexander Macdonald, considered the father of Canada. One of 8 out of 10 of the fathers of Canadian Confederation who were either Scottish or of Scottish stock, Macdonald penned most of the resolutions in Canada's constitution. His dedication to a unified Canada became a reality as the provinces of Ontario, Quebec, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia came together. A few years later, the Hudson Bay Company agreed to sell its land to the new Canada, adding the vast Rupert's Land and Northwestern Territory to the new nation. Macdonald served Canada as its first Prime Minister for 19 years, part of a remarkable political career that spanned almost half a century. In another episode, we'll continue to explore the influence of the Scots in Canada, with a look at accomplishments in the military, transportation, banking, education, and the arts. A number of books are available that outline Canada's history and the involvement of the Scots. Two in particular that I found helpful include Great Scots, How the Scots Created Canada by Matthew Shaw, and The Canadians by Ogden Tanner from the editors of Time Life Books. That's it for this episode of Simply Scottish. Share your comments on this show and listen to other episodes at simplyscottish.com. Join our Scottish community at facebook.com/simplyscottish or at Twitter with @simplyscottish. And if you enjoy the music on the show, you can get your hands on a free Scottish album of your choice by entering our monthly music giveaway, sponsored by musicscotland.com. Enter online at www.simplyscottish.com. We'll close with music from new band The Music of Pride. This is a rousing song called Rise. I'm Andrew McDermott. Join me again soon for more of all things Scottish, right here on Simply Scottish.
Come on, rise now, Bonnie Scotland, and show the whole world that you are there. When if we rise now, Bonnie Scotland, because your time is almost there.
Simply Scottish is hosted and produced by Andrew McDermott. Show content, copyright 2013, Simply Scottish Media. All music is used with consent of copyright holders. Continue your Simply Scottish experience at simplyscottish.com. Thanks for listening.
Bonnie Scotland, and show the world your smile, your grace. Scotland and show the whole world that you are there. Well, up with eyes now, Bonnie Scotland, because your time